back to order here if we can, and proceed with our morning's agenda. We've next got a presentation on the, primarily the board manual development, but also the other related sort of board staff side action items from the May meeting. So Mark and Mark.
Morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'm Mark Engel. I'm a Force Practices Assistant Division Manager for Policy and Services. And
good morning, Mark Racklin. I work for Mark.
Also Policy and Services. Mark is supervises the DNR staff for the Force Practices Board. You've received a memo from me, and it's outlining three elements that we're addressing that are contained within two of the board's main motions, as well as the status of the Attorney General's opinion, legal opinion, based on that question that the commissioner posed. I'm going to start in order and go through, beginning with the rulemaking, and then Mark is going to describe the status of the qualified expert group that is developing the first phase of the Force Practices Board Manual as called for in the board motion. And then I will do give a combined update on both LIDAR and, again, the Attorney General's progress. After each section, I'll pause if the board wants to discuss each thing individually. So the rule, board manual, and then followed by the last two elements. Rulemaking. In May, the board directed staff to initiate formal rulemaking to clarify DNR's authority to require additional information needed to appropriately classify force practice applications where the presence of potentially unstable slopes may threaten public safety. Though this is a procedural rulemaking, in large part, upon review of the Administrative Procedures Act, the staff decided to embrace the more robust process involved in a significant legislative rule. What this means is that, and I'll just go in order, so staff, after receiving the motion direction from the board, we did file the CR 101, the pre-proposal statement for inquiry in May, which indicates the board's intention to undertake this rulemaking. We have prepared draft rule language, and I would say when on the chart that you got, we're probably a little more than 90% done with that. It's one of those things where you put it down and have to review it to see how well the language really fits. And we've had to put a lot of thought into this. And then we're also preparing a cost-benefit analysis and the small business economic impact statement. The addition of those final two products are the bulk of the extra work required for a significant legislative rule. The rulemaking will amend WAC 222.20.010, which directs DNR to prescribe the form and contents of a Force Practice Act. It will allow DNR to request additional information when needed to appropriately classify a Force Practice, and it is a procedural change to the application process, or it may pose. The rule is being developed under the APA for significant legislative rule, as I've just said. Staff will present the draft rule language, as well as the draft cost-benefit analysis and SBIS to the board at your November meeting. Upon board approval of these products, staff will then file the CR 102, initiating formal rulemaking, which will include public meeting and at least one public meeting, and the ability for the public to make written comment. This means DNR does not necessarily have to, in a formal way, implement call interested stakeholders together to have a meeting to review the proposed rule language. DNR, however, is prepared is planning to contact the caucus leads late this month to distribute the draft rule language and indeed assemble and hold a stakeholder meeting to review the draft rule language. With that, I'll pause if the board wants to discuss the vote.
Board Member Stanton.
I got a little confused with that, Mark, because you don't have to go through stakeholder, but you're going to?
By tradition, and we laid this out in the memo, for all rules, those that, so to be specific, any rule that is affecting protection, primarily public resources, which most rules are, but in this case also the threats to public safety, where there's actual extra mitigation or protective measures, we need to go through the depth of management process and have a review. Actually, to be specific, it calls for any effects to acquired resources. By tradition, we do it for all of our rules, even those that are procedural. Outside of an expedited rulemaking, where, and I can give you the example, when the legislature decided to eliminate the Forest Practices Appeals Board and instead put all of our appeals in front of the Pollution Control Hearings Board, in that rulemaking we did not have, it was expedited, it was by direction of the legislature, and we could, you know, pretty much shorten the whole process and just make the rulemaking.
Is there a way, I think that, you know, in my mind, is there a way to do an expedited adaptive management process where we just kind of keep the process, and I think the important process, in place, but fast track it?
That's in many ways what we are planning on doing on this, and that we would, we intend to contact all of the caucus leads, inform them of a meeting, invite them to come to the meeting, and prior to the meeting, send out the draft rule language for review. And by we would not convene a stakeholder group and schedule a series of meetings where we slowly develop the rule, and then in each meeting we review the drafts of the last rule and continue to write it. In this case, it's very simple, it's very straightforward, it's adding clarity to one rule, stating that within our authority, the existing authority that we have, that we may ask for additional information.
Other questions on progress of the rulemaking? So just clarity of for the board and for staff, we're expecting 102 to be prepared to take action on 102 at the November meeting, including the stakeholder process that can be accommodated in a period of time between now and then. If I can restate.
Yes.
If I could, just one. When you send out the invitation for the adaptive management stakeholders for that meeting, I assume that the small end or the representative will have the opportunity to be at that meeting.
So when our usual contacts, when we intend to invoke any sort of a stakeholder process, whether it just be one meeting or for example, the board manual development, we contact the policy leads. So in the case of the Small Forest Landowner Caucus, we would contact Dick Miller. The expectation is that those caucus leads then will work within their caucus to find the appropriate people to attend the meeting or help populate a stakeholder group, a qualified expert group, so to speak.
Sorry, would you repeat the timing on that again? So you're going to have some draft language out to folks before this meeting. About when would that happen, and then when would
So we have right now a lot of work is all kind of coming to the head right at this moment, and you'll hear in detail from Mark Ratcliffe on the qualified expert group and their work on phase one of the board meeting. At the same time, we're also landing on final draft language for the rule, and we're about half done with both the cost-benefit analysis and SBEIS. So we're looking at probably the third week, towards the end of September, that we'll contact the caucus leads. And you're going to hear kind of a little repetition when we go into board manual, because it's that same time frame that we're also going to contact caucus leads regarding the board manual. So late this month, and not to jump on Mark's presentation, but the last scheduled meeting for the qualified expert group is next week. So we're trying to get everything to a draft stage, in a good draft, before we forward any of the materials out for review.
So when would the materials be coming in? The draft wording, I should say, of the just the rule.
Possibly next week. We may actually wait till the week after, so we do them both at the same time.
Mark Ratliff.
For the board manual, just before we go into the board manual discussion, just to clarify a few points for the board. The Forest Practice Board Manual is an advisory technical supplement to the rules. DNR is directed to prepare the board manual and then submit the manual to the board for approval. DNR is to prepare the manual in cooperation with stakeholders, but DNR takes the lead. The Adaptive Management Program is to provide science-based recommendations and technical information to assist the board in for both rule and in the amending of the manual. I want to point that out, that the rule holds that these things are to be done. The board motion directed DNR to amend Board Manual Section 16, the guidelines to evaluating potential stable slopes and landform, in two phases. In the first phase, the board specifically asked DNR to convene a panel of qualified experts to address the first topic. So DNR believes that we were faithfully fulfilling the board's direction in the motion when we assembled the qualified experts to amend the manual to include the information required for the first phase of the manual. So now I will turn it over to Mark, and he'll give an outline of all the work that the group has done.
Good morning, Chair and members of the board. Mark Ratliff. I've been facilitating a work group that's been incorporating material and added amendments to the board manual. So a kind of brief overview of where we came and where we are now. In June, because of the board's motion, we convened a stakeholder group. We purposely sought out individuals who worked in these fields of identifying, assessing groundwater recharge and the deep sea landslides. We wanted a broad range from backgrounds, so we looked at academic places, we looked at state agencies, we looked at those on our qualified expert list and consultant, those are consulting geologists. From that, we got a wide range. We have one of the Department of Transportation's most accredited geologists. Several of the folks have PhDs. Four, I believe, are licensed geologists in Washington. One is practicing in Oregon. We have a professor from Portland State University. And so they have a good background, a good base to which to bring now more information into the board manual. And we also wanted folks who did this as a career, who studied landslides, who evaluate landslides and groundwater areas as well. So most of July and August, the group reviewed the current literature and compiled an extensive list of resources to go into the manual. From that, we have five appendices that were being incorporated now. They established the outline and the flow. We looked at the existing board manual and where that can be improved in not only flow, but also an outline that would bring in their research and their knowledge and their understanding of how qualified experts do this in the field. Most of the end of August was still
getting the right places, getting the right language. The first, or the last week meeting, we looked at language. And this next week, we're putting the finishing touches on language. There's improved diagrams, there's improved illustrations that the group has brought in. So we're on the downwards part right now. Some of the relevant information that we're bringing into this manual, and I may not address, be able to address the technical questions, but these are some of the elements that we're bringing in now that were not in the existing board manual. They've improved methods to help landowners identify all types of landforms. And if you look at the table of contents, that was attachment one in Martin Engel's memo, I can kind of reference where that is in the manual. The methods to help landowners identify all types of landforms is sprinkled throughout. There's not a specific area we targeted. The group brought in internationally adopted classification system to identify landforms. And that is helpful to identify the features that point to glacial or deep sea landslides, I should say. The language that folks are using in professional and research didn't always mirror with the language or descriptions that the existing manual used. So we had to relate those to the existing, but we also had to use what, you know, current science and literature points to now. They helped to clarify what indicators might point to landforms that fall under category E under WAC 222-16050. And category E is the other landforms, and it would go through the Class 4 special. There will be better description of glacial deep-seated landslides. Deep-seated landslides was talked about in the existing manual, but now we've improved the aspect of glacial. But what came out of part of this discussion and the language that they're bringing is that glacial is a type of, or glacial deep-sea landslide is a type of deep-sea landslide, but in that case, it's the material that the landslide is in. And so they wanted to recognize that, you know, landslides could occur in anything, and if it's glacial materials, then that's what brings it up to a glacial landslide. It seems pretty elementary, but there is a distinguish that they want people to know and landowners to understand. Let's see. So they've also expanded how a qualified expert might identify and delineate the groundwater recharge. I know that was some questions earlier this morning. Let me go back. So where the added information to help clarify what indicators might point to landforms that fall under category E, that is in part 5.6, almost middle of the page, other indicators of slope instability or active movement. The better descriptions of glacial deep sea landslides are going to be also found in 5.6. And then where we've improved descriptions and guidance for groundwater recharge are in 5.3 under the groundwater recharge area, but also in 5.6 take that back, also in 6.3. If you see 6.3 is a total new section or part, I should say, office and field assessment for groundwater recharge areas and deep sea landslides.
In the previous version of the board manual, it was not organized this way.
No.
I don't recall there being an overview of assessments or procedures.
That is correct.
And that's an improvement or a change that's been adopted with this set of recommendations.
That is correct, yeah. So my next bullet might hit on this one. So another thing they did is provide improved guidance to what the qualified expert does in the field to assess these landforms. And Part six is quite a bit of information of how a office review would look, how a field review would look, and then part 6.3 is to stay true to the board's motion and given our timeline. We said, okay, let's see how an office review and a field review assessment might look for groundwater recharge areas. It'd be great to have an office review field for any platform at this point with these. And then part seven is also where we have improved what a qualified expert does to assess these landforms. And part seven is new as well. We did use some of the existing, there was a delivery part. That was existing board manual, and we used some of that, but improved it with better guidance, what the qualified experts are doing, what researchers are doing. We expanded the bibliography and added several technical resources for qualified experts to identify and assess these features. The second page of the table of contents shows Appendix A through E. There's actually now an F that's not showing here, but that's several pages of good information of where resources are, where databases are, in some degree how to even find reports. They've also incorporated assessment procedures for determining the risk and reactivation, and that's mostly in Part 7. Part 7.1 through 7.4 are new amended language and guides. I mentioned a little bit about how 6 is a very good overview and a description of how to and what a office and field review assessment would look like. What is neat to see is that they've written it to the layperson, what you might do, and then also what the qualified expert needs to look at to inform them then when they get to the technical report that DNR would receive. So that's a wrap-up of the biggest nuggets. There's a lot other, and I don't have the time to go through that, but those are the big nuggets that we've incorporated so far.
I'm assuming that as part of additional content that to the extent we have sort of rule described components of geotechnical reports, that Section 10 here is sort of cross-referenced to new sources of information, types of procedures, that sort of thing. Is there, in other words, to have some specificity about the geotech report content that's linked back into, for example, the appendices or other places that might be appropriate in the revisions? Is that sort of tied together?
Yeah. So 10 is existing, but we've improved on it, of course. And then in that, they've been able to say, okay, you know, for this information or to inform you on this decision, I don't know exactly the appendices would be. But these would be sources, these would be areas to help that technical report pass all the elements that DNR would require. Is that, Aaron?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, does that get that?
Yes. Questions?
Yeah, this is a question for Mark. First of all, it's great to see this progress. It really is. And I know that it's all kind of this compressed time frame. I mean, it actually equals months, obviously, but in terms of the type of work we do and the detailed work we have to do, it's really quite impressive. I'm just a little bit confused still between phase one and phase two. As you outlined in your memo, so what is phase two?
So phase two is the mechanisms for delivery. how do you calculate the potential runout? And what Mark had said is the current manual addresses that, but not into any sort of great detail, nor does it offer any sort of methods in which could be deployed to calculate that. So phase two is going to require a reconvening of qualified experts to go through all of the types of methods or processes that are currently deployed within the industry and then put together guidance that we can include in the board. But for this group right now, the primary emphasis is in a lot of it is in the reorganization, is trying to put together a very good process for that field practitioner as well as the geologist could use to systematically go through. And what you'll hear this afternoon is that for all of these things, even for the geotechnical report, it's a review followed by another review followed by another review. It's that redundancy that the manual is promoting. And you start from a remote and you go into the field, and each individual player or participant in the whole process, we're promoting that everybody has to do from the remote to the field. So the manual has done a very good job of building those redundancies, of emphasizing the need for ultimately the boots on the ground and promoting the expertise needed in order to make the assessments.
Board Member Stanley.
I'll sound like a broken record, but just a concern I do have is, you know, really good transparency with all stakeholders, that we've got time to review, provide input, you know, for everybody, so that it's a transparent process going through.
Okay, so to pick up my present, if there's no more.
Okay, Board Member Sullivan.
You go first.
All right. This is for Mark also. So is part of this, that what comes out of this, some sort of, or comes elsewhere, some sort of risk scale? I mean, some of these features are, just identifying them is difficult, identifying where they are, deliberately where they could go, but there's different levels of risk, and this harkens back to how you make decisions. And some areas are going to be more sensitive than others. I mean, is there a risk assessment or some sort of rating that comes out of this, all of this? Or is it strictly technical identification and identifying the factors on the ground?
No, there is an element of that. So 7.1, landslide activity, and 7.4, slope stability sensitivity. So those get at your question. The activity, we incorporated, you know, dormant. I only play a geologist on TV, so I'm not going to try. So, but the age, what features to look at, you know, is there a potential for active movement, or has this been long gone? So that teases out, you know, for a layperson, but also a qualified expert, in your assessment, these are things that we expect, VNR expects you to inform us on, of your professional, your professional advice, your professional opinion of would this fail or would this not. 7.4, so that is how then to do a quantitative assessment. And we don't go through, I mean, we could volumes of how to do one, but what elements need to be in that assessment to further inform the geotech report and DNR as well.
Yeah, I guess also be a broken record. The critical part is you go from the technical world, the assessment world, to the management world. There's a difference there in understanding the potential for damage to something is part of the question the managers probably need to know when they're doing their prescriptions. And it's kind of in this interface. I see parts of it here, but I just want to make sure that clearly is part of the thinking here. And it seems the manual needs to give guidance on that to the people that actually have to make decisions and do prescriptions on the ground.
the manual stresses the need in the assessments to again look at the activity of the feature. This afternoon, I think, is probably will really help, I think, clarify the process that we, again, it's also going to show the kind of the redundancy and the review of these things where, the qualified expert is going to prepare the geotechnical report or any other information that we need in order to review the application. The role of our science team, who are all licensed engineering geologists, is to go look at that work and then make an assessment, that very assessment of the risk and the quality of the work. So I think this afternoon, I think we'll probably answer those questions a little more, that the guidance is strong. However, when we do open it up for review, that is the opportunity for people to look and make sure that it stresses the points that we want to stress. But all of the elements will be included within the board manual as far as guidance. And it's also will be stressed when we talk about the process this afternoon, which is also in part with the new field form and the additional review that we're taking.
Thank you. Board members, Sweeney.
So I have a similar question, but a slightly different angle of it. So there's risk associated with landslide activity. And I'm assuming, but correct me if I'm wrong, that there's also risk associated with uncertainty about both where the line, essentially, we had a discussion about how you delineate the groundwater recharge area, and then what's happening underneath. And I would expect that all of this work is going to lead to some reduction in that uncertainty because it's an improvement over the guidance that's been there in the past. But I would also assume that uncertainty isn't completely eliminated. And so my question might also be answered later this afternoon, but my question is, how will the board manual, and then how will additional processes on top of that deal with whatever uncertainty is left after someone goes through and follows the board manual guidance? So will there be something in the board manual that says, well, we did everything technically feasible, state of the art, to delineate this groundwater recharge area, but we're still not sure where it is? And is there sort of a requirement to describe that uncertainty if it exists? And then I would just want to put a marker for the discussion later this afternoon of if there still is some uncertainty there, what's our role as a board, or what's DNR's role in giving direction to how you approve or not approve or change the boundary of an NPA based on that uncertainty?
Yeah. So I want to answer that with specific of the line, the groundwater line. Mm-hmm. So, the board manual kind of gives the sideboards, and I think I'm stealing language from earlier, but there's a topographical way to delineate that, and then there's the full in-depth drilling. Okay, and we give even some additional opportunities to look at for research for a qualified expert to look at that. But it's still, and once you're on this feature, then that triggers a geotech report. So the geotech report still needs to address the uncertainty or address the risk factor if certain activity goes forward or if there's mitigation required. And then that is then put on them. Once we get it, we evaluate that uncertainty if we believe that this activity should go through or should.
If I may add, this is where the work done that's being done by policy and the technical group, and then ultimately UPSEG, reconstituted UPSEG, is complementing the work that we're doing. So this group is using current methodologies, and to answer board member Summers' earlier question, there are the sideboards from the topographic to the full drilling and methods in the middle. They will be included in the menu. However, this additional answering of the questions for uncertainty that was addressed by both policy and the technical group of people. It's based on that information that we can then make further amendments to the manual if necessary. That's where the complement comes. Right now we're providing, or this group will provide, the current methodologies being deployed in the field. And it's going to be brought up as current as we can make it. And then we're, you know, based on questions to be answered through the science community, then the board will have that additional information from which to direct further change.
Just clarification. So the additional information from the science community, are you talking about what we're going to get soon, or additional information after UPSAC does more research? And you know, of course, it might be yes, both, but that critical period is, you know, based on the presentation this morning, there's lots of things that need to be researched and that we don't know. So the pressure that we're all, you know, we've heard in the public and that we will generate for ourselves is in the face of uncertainty prior to research being done, and especially if that research is going to take some time, you know, then what do we do and how do we handle it? So that's the final point.
It is truly both. However, to address some of the concerns is that I think a fair assessment needs to be made after everybody has been able to review the product that we're developing. And again, they're not done. They have one more meeting scheduled next week. The materials will be coming out in fairly short term. And after that, I think then, you know, we're getting at best, like Paulson did earlier, a really good update of where we're at. There's been a lot of work done. And for our part, we're coming close to the point where we're able to begin to distribute drafts of our work and allow people to see what we've done.
Yeah, I think coming back to this in the afternoon, as far as maybe give just a little bit more thought about how we might want to see the board manual address situations of uncertainty that are less than crystal clear about where the line is. I believe that content-wise, it would be an element that underlies the full breadth of what's in the board manual. So I think maybe that's why there's a little struggle with the question, is that the quality of information or precision of the information, unless I completely miss my guess, is discussed throughout the layers of guidance that are encapsulated within the board manual. So finding a way to kind of call that out and deal with it as a matter of board guidance and policy is maybe a question. Other questions on board manual before we move on?
So, just to verify, the group will finish in mid-September. Staff will need a little bit of time after the last meeting with the group to format and catch all the typos and put it into a product that's presentable. There's a lot of, right now the work is going entirely into content, but that final, so it'll probably be at least a week after the final meeting of the group before we'll have a draft that we can present. So again, probably the third week of September. DNR is planning on presenting the draft manual, including the amendments for phase one, to the board for the review and approval at their November meeting. Phase two, however, we're going to, immediately after this draft is out, we're going to contact the policy leads and request that we get qualified experts. Again, we do need that expertise to reconstitute another group. It may be some of the same individuals, and begin to address phase two, which is the run out, the delivery potential. That will not be completed for the November meeting. And in fact, Right now, we haven't even put together a schedule yet as to how many meetings we think we'll have, but it will take some time. And so the certainty is that it will not be ready for the November meeting.
Do you feel like you'll have enough of a scope discussion between now and the November meeting to firm up the timeline a little bit, and knowing a bit about the issue for the benefit of the board members? Estimating run out is an extraordinarily complicated and sort of notoriously unreliable thing to do. And so what we've asked is to try and pull together the best available information and methodology out there around that subject. And I think the reason that the timeline isn't very clear at this point is just because staff need to sit down with some preliminary discussions with the experts and talk about how that task can be accomplished. But I would anticipate for you that the act of doing that creates a bunch more questions that you're probably going to need to come back to the board and talk a little bit about. So is that?
We will give an update at the November meeting over the status of the phase two with as much information as we can get. I would hope that includes an estimated timeline. So, to finish up with you, there was an element of a motion requesting the availability of bare earth LIDAR. As you heard this morning in general public comment, we did include within the memo a map showing the existing LIDAR coverage. I believe that most of that is consortium LIDAR that's available to the public. However, within, I think it's like a yellow shaded, there is a wide range in the quality of the LIDAR that's available. So, it's not a very large percentage of that entire area is a real high quality LIDAR. Not to say that it isn't all useful, but there is a wide range in the quality.
In turn, can I just expand on that? In terms of quality, most of the yellow shaded is going to be of sufficient precision to be able to tease out glacial deep sea slides just by virtue of how obvious they tend to be on the landscape. And the concern, I think, is more about shallow rapid landslides and the need for greater precision to help pin down shallow rapid features.
If you have, you know, say, 10 DEM, and I don't know what the quality of the LIDAR is, but the more coarse the LIDAR is, the more likely that you could miss shallow rapids. However, the chairman is correct in that deep-seated landslides in general will tend to show up on all of the available LIDAR. Reiterate what you were told this morning, DNR has initiated discussions with representatives of WFPA about the availability of bare earth LIDAR data. We will get a further update at the November meeting. The commissioner's request for attorney general review for the potential of a moratorium reiterate what has happened. On May 22nd, Commissioner Goldmark sent a letter requesting Attorney General formal opinion on several legal questions. They were, does the Forest Practice Board have the authority to adopt a moratorium on the acceptance or approval of forest practice apps that propose a risk to public safety due to potential slope instability? And if the board cannot adopt a moratorium, can it accomplish a similar result by adopting emergency rule? And if so, what procedural steps must the board follow to adopt such an emergency rule? The Attorney General's office determined that a legal opinion is appropriate. On June 2nd, they filed the opinion request with the Office of the Code Revisor. It was posted in the State Register. with a request for public to notify the Attorney General's office on their interest to comment by June 25th of 2014. I believe that they were then provided a time frame after they requested the right to comment. That has closed, and then it does take time for a legal opinion to be made. To date, we have not received any information from the Attorney General's office, nor do we have any sort of firm date which will get a legal opinion.
Okay. Does that conclude the presentation?
It does.
Any questions before we go to lunch? Okay. See y'all back here at 1 o'clock.